minutes we've been here, and now he was getting out. Now he's out. Now we find out.
Look at this. The boss man is helpless. He's absolutely helpless.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 77 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, taking a look at WWF Superstars from June 6, 1992, which was a kind of, sort of, request by somebody that was sent to me in a chat. I don't really take requests too often. I certainly take suggestions, and I put them in the lengthy queue. This one actually happened to be in the queue. However, there were some issues with the video that came up that I'm going to explain when I get to the end, because it was actually really kind of an unpleasant surprise that I did not realize as I was watching the video. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. You're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon for all of your Amazon purchases. And I see you're probably listening to the show on Pro Wrestling Only because, I don't know, I look at the download numbers occasionally, and I realized last week I should probably do more new, different stuff. Like when I doing Smoky Mountain last week, it seemed like there was more people listening. I just kind of got that vibe. Like the numbers seemed really, really high. But it was also one hell of a coincidence that I chose to do a Smoky Mountain show the same weekend as the Scenic City Invitational, and also, you know, in Chattanooga and Easton. Oh my God. It's been a long day for me. I'm taping this on a Monday night, and I worked right up to about 8 o'clock because I'm the only person who can cover stuff at my job. And working in mutual funds sometimes can be a hideous bitch goddess, although the goddess has just sort of left town. Although I'd be willing to accept a job elsewhere, especially on the asset management side rather than the asset servicing side. Wink, wink. So anyway, yeah, don't mind me if my accent betrays me here. I've also had one beer, which I'm going to call my beer of the week. It is from Switchback Brewing up in Burlington, Vermont, a place that I've actually visited this brewery. And their bottles are very much reminiscent of the Red Stripe bottles you see with the little stubby top. They're not long neck bottles, but they're coming out with cans now soon. Anyway, name of the beer is Dampf Punk, which I don't know if it's supposed to be a playoff Daft Punk or whatever. It is a hoppy California-style common beer, which California common is generally most recognizable in the form of Anchor Steam. However, you cannot call it steam beer because Anchor copyrighted it. And I don't know how I got onto all the... Oh, yeah, I was explaining my accent there and all that sort of business. And it probably won't get any better when I talk about how on Saturday I went out for oysters and beer. And oysters, if you can eat them, and I know some people have allergies and some people have an aversion to raw fish of that kind, they're really just the best. I love having oysters. Just finding out about oysters, it's just you order blind and you order sometimes by what the name of the oyster is. I was at this place called Island Creek Oyster, which is in Burlington, Mass., and they also have a location in Boston as well, and ordering this oyster called the Mookie Blues, just simply because, you know, Mookie Betts has been having a pretty good year for the Red Sox. I mean, not quite to the level of Manny Machado, but he's done a pretty good job, and the Red Sox have managed to win a few games here and there. And I figured that they must be selling a ton of those oysters just on the name alone, even if they didn't have a player named Mookie. Just, it's a fun name to kind of say and to order. So oysters and beer is always recommended by me. And on Sunday, for those of you who do follow me on the Twitter, you already know this. I went to the New Hampshire Fisher Cats taking on the Erie Sea Wolves. I don't know if there are any Sea Wolves in Erie, Pennsylvania. It feels like one of those names that's just kind of BS. Like, I bought tickets for another Fisher Cats game in 3 weeks against the Binghamton Rumble Ponies. What is a Rumble Pony? Is it a Royal Rumble Pony? I don't get it. And I bought tickets in the front row behind the on-deck circle, which of the visiting team, which is the seats that I like the most. And I was very excited for Binghamton because Tim Tebow plays for them. And then 10 minutes after I bought the ticket, I realized that Tim Tebow had broken his wrist and is out for the season. So I will not be able to strike up a conversation with the former Heisman Trophy winner from Florida in a couple of weeks. But, oh well, I'm sure I'll have a good time anyway. So, superstars, June of 92, like a lot of people, I was checked out of the WWF at this point because I had gotten WrestleMania 8 on pay-per-view. And I have this distinct memory of something that had happened with, I'm really kind of shocked I didn't get mad about this when it happened at the time. And it's that I was told that if I didn't get any wrestling pay-per-views for a while, for like an undetermined period of time, I could get cable TV in my bedroom. And I never really followed up on that, which kind of maybe should have taught me a lesson that maybe I should have stayed on that. I mean, it's not quite like my new job search right now where I literally apply for 3 to 5 jobs every single day in the hopes of getting an interview. But it never really happened, and I never got a pay-per-view again until fall of 93, as I mentioned a week or two ago, with the 93 Survivor Series in the Boston Garden. And yeah, a lot of people had checked out on the product by the middle of 1992, and the reason why I did probably wasn't some hope that I would get cable TV in my room, because I knew that that wasn't going to happen because of just wiring issues and all that, and also my sisters probably would have put up a stink, or at least my one sister who was still living at home at the time. I think that, like a lot of people, when Hogan left, I was a little disillusioned by that, but I was also upset by Sid becoming a heel, because while I could have just continued cheering for the heel, such is my commitment to kayfabe, that I wasn't going to do it, lest, you know, I be even more of an outcast than I was at the time. He also had the Ultimate Warrior coming back at the same time as Hogan goes away, Warrior comes in, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, we're right back to WrestleMania 6 when I took a lengthy break again because Warrior won and Hogan lost, and then Hogan gets injured for a while and I stop watching for a lengthy period of time in the summer of 1990. It's definitely a time period where I want to cover a show very, very soon. I have one lined up, but it's not a complete show, but there's a certain big angle on the Brother Love show, which you certainly remember. Sid, of course, was out because of concerns with steroids, and just general Sidness. I was going to say, he was down with the Sidness. As a, what was that band? System of the Down? Maybe might have said that. It was Down with the Sickness. But it's close enough, anyway. So Hogan's gone, but he's in the intro to the show, which is always kind of a thing that I use to indicate who the promotion values. And it's kind of a rapid fire of the guys in the promotion. I mean, you even get like Coco Beware in there, who is on the show as one half of High Energy. And not having Sid there after he was such a hope for me all through 1991 and into 1992. It's kind of sad. When you look back on the year 1992, there's so many weird things that happened in the WWF, even removing things like the sexual harassment allegations, the whole steroid thing coming home to roost, and Hogan leaving and all that sort of stuff. You have the title decided in the Royal Rumble, which they don't do again for another 24 years after that, which kind of made that Rumble special, among other reasons why it was special, just because of how perfect it was in terms of its booking. You got Bret Hart with the weird losing in the IC title the Friday before a pay-per-view, which is not something that they had done to that point, where you would change a title match on that short of notice, but a lot of that stuff has been well documented. I'll go into Bret Hart's match on this show. You have Savage winning the title at WrestleMania, but what is not the main event, as the match with Flair takes place middle of the show, and your main event is Hulk Hogan versus Sid Justice, a match where I am one of the few people in the world who actually enjoys that match when I watch it, because I'm a Sid fanboy and I just can't help it. For whatever reason. You know what I think it might be? It might be that Sid kicks out of the leg drop, and I just love that so much. Whether it's accidental or not, I don't care. It's just a moment when Sid kicked out of the leg drop, and I remember thinking at the time, oh my god, he's going to beat Hogan because he kicked out of the finisher. But yeah, Papa Shango, who we have an interview with on this program. So we get a nice little sampling of 1992 WWF. So your main event of WrestleMania, with those two guys, both of them are gone within 6 weeks after WrestleMania. Smash cut, SummerSlam 92. Your main event there is the British Bulldog going over Bret Hart for the Intercontinental title in his homeland, the United Kingdom, in Wembley Stadium, the original Wembley Stadium in London. And British Bulldog, he's gone by the end of the year. So is the Ultimate Warrior, both under similar performance-enhancing circumstances, shall we say. And then by the time you get to December 31st, even Ric Flair has had enough of this whole scene and wants to head on back down south. In 93, you get Monday Night Raw, and everything has just kind of changed at that point. So in the middle of the year, June of 92... This feels like kind of a representative show for the time period, even though, as I had mentioned, there's some issues with this video. There are certain things that are definitely cut out. For example, we don't get any event centers, which always makes me sad because it doesn't allow me to do riffs on the interviews that the guys are doing, talking about coming to the Boston Garden or the Nassau Coliseum or something. I always enjoy that, even though when I originally conceived of this show, it was going to be where I would skip all that stuff, which thank God I didn't, because by like the fifth episode, I said, there's no way in hell I can skip the Event Center promos, because you had like Sid Justice talking about a casket match with The Undertaker at the Nassau Coliseum. Like, how can I not talk about that? Or Jake Roberts basically saying all the lyrics to U2's One in his promo on Macho Man Randy Savage. It's just, I don't know. It's something that I'm glad I altered over time. But about how representative this show is, we got Bret Hart, the Nasty Boys, Kona Crush. Is there a more summer 1992 WWF character than Kona Crush? The Repo Man, who is still sticking around well into 92, and of course even into 93, because he would famously steal Randy Savage's hat, leading to a two-week angle on Monday Night Raw in the Manhattan Center. The Beverly Brothers are around, managed by The Genius, and as I had mentioned, Coco Beware is here with High Energy, so Owen Hart, his tag team partner. In the One Update segment that we get a review of what had taken place the week before. And this is why this show was requested. It was just kind of an offhand, hey, could you do the show where Nails beats the hell out of the Big Boss Man? Well, technically, that is the Superstars the week before this. So this took, this of course, June 6th, so there would have been the last show in the month of May. And you can't find it anywhere on YouTube or on Daily Motion. I think it's one of those that gets flagged, probably for that angle, even though this angle is mostly replayed. It's not replayed in full during the update segment. It's kind of humorous the way they play things with Okerlund in the event center or wherever he's doing that from. But you know, we'll get a little review of the Boss Man and Nails. And of course, an interview with Papa Shango well into his voodoo tricks phase in the WWF, and the number of problems that that would cause in his feud with the Ultimate Warrior. And I didn't split immediately after WrestleMania 8. I did stick around for a while, and I remember watching some weekly TVs. And you know what? I'll save that for the Papa Shango interview segment because, oh boy, I got some things to say about that. So with all that in mind, why don't we just jump right into the show?
Some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee.
One interesting thing about this taping is that it took place in Lexington, Kentucky at the Rupp Arena. It's interesting because you usually think of the TV tapings in upstate New York and Poughkeepsie, Syracuse, Glens Falls. These are all places that they taped in 1992. So to have them in the Rupp Arena a couple of months after Kentucky's infamous loss to Christian Laettner and Duke. You would think that they were more in the Northeast, but this is kind of the outlier of the tapings that they did in that year. Anyway, first match is the Intercontinental Champion, Bret the Hitman Hart, taking on Tom Stone. And it does make you ask, what year is this? Because Bret Hart and Tom Stone overlap in the WWF for a very long period of time. And Bret's there from 84 to you know when. And Tom Stone is there right up through April of 95. He's working a challenge taping. And you didn't realize he's there that late. I mean, this is a guy who was on the AWA Super Sunday in 1983. So, yeah, you know, it's 1992. Let's be clear. And Bret kisses the Intercontinental belt, probably glad and secure that he screwed up with his contract and couldn't jump to WCW in January as he had originally kind of envisioned for himself. I wrote about this a little bit in my Model Year Wrestler series that I did on my blog, section309.com, which I always say that I'm going to write more for it, and then I never get the time for it because I always get caught up in other projects, like coming up with trivia questions for the Place to Be podcast episode 500 trivia contest, which is coming up in September. So that was some fun that I had the other day. So I'm wondering, the whole concept, we know what happened to Bret Hart in when he made that jump to WCW at the end of 1997, and then he goes through 1998. It was a complete disaster by really any standard you can think of, given how hot he was after making the jump. But let's go back to 1992. Let's think about what Bret Hart would have been in WCW at that time. You think of the promotion, he would have been signed during the Kip Allen Fry period, which came to an end 3 or 4 months later. Bill Watts comes in. You have to assume that all of that would have stayed exactly the same. And if you do that, you say, okay, how would Bill Watts have treated a guy like Bret Hart? Well, let's remember that when Watts came into the WWF for that very brief and bizarre period in the fall of 1995, he was one of the advocates for keeping Bret Hart on top rather than Shawn Michaels. So it would lead me to believe that he would have been pushed very heavily in 1992 WCW by Bill Watts' regime, because he's a wrestler's wrestler, I guess you could say. What that does to Ron Simmons on the side, it's really kind of hard to say, but I do think he gets pushed as sort of the Sting substitute. Now, I don't know what happens with Bret and the Sharpshooter, because then he's in a promotion where the number one babyface, as he comes in, has the same finishing hold as Bret. So one of them would have to give it up. And you would have to think that Bret would have to come up with a different move. And I would imagine that he would have come up with a different submission style. Or perhaps he would have just gone back to the pile driver that he used for years and years before that singles push in 1991 took hold. Here in 92, this is actually the start of a feud with Shawn Michaels, which I'm sure nothing's bad is ever going to happen between those two guys going forward. But this one kind of got cut off, and I don't mean it got cut off in Vince McMahon came down to ringside and told the ring announcer to ring the bell. Sean is being managed by Sensational Sherry, who does not yet have eyes for the model Rick Martel, which leads into the SummerSlam match, which is a fun little angle, but certainly screams of, we don't have anything for either of these guys to do right now, but as far as that goes, it's about as good as you can get with the don't hit the guy in the face stipulation. And even Shawn's promo here, as much as I dislike Shawn Michaels as a human being and a professional wrestler, I guess this isn't too horrible considering some of the stuff he would do later.
What a lucky mirror. And why wouldn't it be? He gets to look back at me every single day. But you know, one guy that's not going to be so lucky is you, Hitman, when I take the Intercontinental title.
Now, of course, they wouldn't abort the feud before doing the WWF's first ladder match on July 21st in Portland, Maine, which, speaking of oysters, that's a hell of a city for good beer and good oysters. And they would, of course, revisit it at the Survivor Series in 1992 when Brett defeated Shawn cleanly. And Shawn's the Intercontinental Champion at that point, but Brett is the World Champion, so they're both in a very good place. I need to remark about Tom Stone. I always note that he's incredibly pale. He's certainly one of the paler jobbers, which is saying a lot, but he's also a guy who never once bladed in his entire career. The reason being that you can't get blood from a stone. Brett does the sharpshooter tease where he grabs Stone's legs like he's going to go for it and then looks around and decides to stomp him in the stomach because he's a professional and he realizes, if I let this thing go for another 2 minutes, that's another 2 minutes for both Vince and Mr. Perfect to put me over to the television audience. So always kind of a smart move. That's why I never understand why the 40-second squash match, unless the guy is truly a monster like a Goldberg or later a Braun Strowman. Russian leg sweep, and then finally we get the sharpshooter from Brett. And after the victory, the camera does some interesting cuts. First thing we see is a woman in a belly shirt where you can certainly see the, you know, a lot of midriff. And then to a blonde woman with really, really tall hair. So I guess that kind of confirms that Kevin Dunn was getting increasing influence over the TV in 1992.
Hi again, folks. Update brought to you by IcoPro, the integrated conditioning program scientifically designed to give you the advantage in building your body.
Lucky for you, this stuff doesn't work.
IcoPro is another staple of 92 WWF, although I might associate it more with 1993, just seeing the banner hanging on the balcony of the Manhattan Center. So Okerlund takes us back a week earlier to the Big Boss Man's match against Dave Roulette, whose name is spelled like Roulette, the table game, so you'd have to think he would have been a natural tag team partner down the road if he would just change the pronunciation for the gambler in WCW. Can you imagine those two guys? Like, one of them brings a roulette wheel to the ring with him, and the other guy's got, like, a deck of cards. I mean, they team up with Vinny Vegas, and you got a whole damn stable going anyway. But I digress. So this is being billed as the worst beating ever by Nails, coming out of the crowd to attack the Big Boss Man at the end of his match. And we have to take a step back and forget about kayfabe for a minute. The Boss Man, kind of a dick a lot of times, even after he was a babyface. You know, the handcuffing guys to the ropes who he had already subdued and soundly defeated to the point where he could pin them with just one hand for a three count. I don't think you need to handcuff him to the ropes and beat the crap out of them with a nightstick. I mean, that's a little much and is a little weird for a babyface, I think. And thank God the Boss Man didn't face too many African-American jobbers, because that would look really bad in retrospect with the guy playing the prison guard slash police officer kind of role and beating up a person of color. But let's just skip right past that. As Nails comes out in his orange jumpsuit, because apparently they don't give you clothes when you get out of prison, whatever you came in with. Apparently he had to leave in the outfit he was given, which said DOC, so Department of Correction, number 902-714. And I looked it up, wondering, could that number have any sort of significance? You know, is there any sort of hidden meaning? And no, of course not. I mean, they're not thinking of that sort of thing. They probably just threw those numbers together. Maybe Pritchard has answered that on his podcast, but I don't subscribe to the $46 tier where you might hear an answer to that question. I know in The Simpsons, when Principal Skinner finds his helmet that he was forced to wear as a POW in Vietnam, and he's listed as prisoner 24601 or 26401. It's the same one as Jean Valjean from Les Mis, the musical. So I always liked when stuff like that is thrown in there. There was something of a build to this, so it's not like random dude attacks him from the crowd wearing a prisoner jumpsuit. They had played some vignettes where he's got a voice distortion thing where he says that he's out and he's coming to get the boss man for some beating that he received in prison, some sort of retribution. So you think, okay, well, here's this monster that they're building up. And Vince McMahon, he's there. He's going to put this guy over correctly the first time so that he's a superstar for years to come. I mean, you think of all the other examples of Vince introducing a character, putting him over strongly. One of the ones that I think of, which was actually his last play-by-play appearance, was, "It's gotta be Kane!" I mean, it may not be the greatest in the world, but you certainly remember him saying, "That's gotta be Kane." Well, to get to that point in 1997, he had to have a few stumbles first, and I think this might be one of them.
Wait a minute, who is that man? I have no idea who that is.
That's got to be him. Doesn't sound so good. They didn't have a name for the prisoner yet. Of course, that would be one of the WCW names that they would come up with. Highly original that they bring Kevin Kelly, as he was known in the AWA, Kevin Wacholt, over and call him the prisoner in effectively the same gimmick. Instead, they decide to call him Nails going forward. And a little bit more on that name in a second, but this kind of attack, and it was pretty brutal, him choking the boss man with the nightstick. It goes on for quite a while, and the crowd is mostly hushed by this. And it kind of made me think that when you have a beatdown that is this severe, seems like it goes over a lot better the smaller the venue is. Like in a TV studio, like Mid-Atlantic Wrestling or, you know, one of the territories back in the day, it seems like that would get the most kind of crowd heat is an attack like this. But everything seems to be mostly hushed. I mean, I'm thinking back to Techwood Studios 1988 when the original Midnight Express, Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey show up to beat up Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane, the Midnight Express, and noise that that crowd was making. And this, it kind of gets lost in the venue. I mean, Rupp Arena is the home of the University of Kentucky Wildcats. I mean, this is not the smallest place in the world. I don't think that they filled it in the middle of 1992, but that's not really the point. I just think it comes off better in a smaller space. And also, because this goes on for quite a while, I'm wondering, where are all the boss man's friends to help him? Like, where is Virgil to help him? And maybe Virgil took a look at the boss man and said, you know what, the brother had this coming, given some of the beatings that he's doled out over time. Conversely, I'm wondering, how does this guy get released from prison, given that he is making threats against a former prison guard from that prison? It's something that they could probably detain the guy for a little bit longer. But then I remember he used the voice distorter. So it kind of, hey, some actual storytelling that sort of pays off. And the thing gets so brutal, they don't show the entire act or whatever. And Gene kind of interrupts it by like looking off camera to his left. And they cut back to him and he's basically like, turn this off right now. So they're really putting it over as a truly brutal beating. And I guess for the time period it was. I mean, it's not Jake sicking his cobra on Randy Savage, which we is only 8 months in the rearview mirror, but watching the WWF at this time, it feels like 100 years before, because Jake is another one of those guys that's long gone. But finally, we're going to get down to the business and give this guy a name.
By the way, we have now learned that the perpetrator of that vicious attack is an ex-con who answers to the name of Nails. Nails, apparently a moniker bestowed upon this hardened criminal by his fellow inmates.
Or maybe he was just a big fan of Philly center fielder Lenny Dykstra, who was a kind of a star at the time, although he always seemed to be injured quite a bit. I know in 92 he didn't play after around mid-August. He played the game hard, so he would get hurt a lot, but it's part of the problem. If you can't count on a guy to play the full season, he becomes a lot less valuable. But interestingly enough, and only I would look this sort of thing up, Lenny Dykstra, from the time that Nails debuted, and let's take it from the date that the run-in aired, so May 30th, up through his last game that he played that season, as I said, it was in mid-August. It was 55 games when Lenny Dykstra is playing for the Phillies concurrent with Nails in the WWF, and he batted .330 with a .398 on-base percentage, 3 home runs, 23 stolen bases, which in 55 games factors out to about 60-65 stolen bases over the course of a full season. So if you could have got a full season out of Lenny Dykstra, as they did in 1993 when the Phillies won the National League pennant, and he scored 143 runs, which, remember, he got off to such an incredible start that year, and the Phillies kind of ran away with the National League East crown. He's also a guy who has a bit of a personality, for better or worse. I mean, the Mets got rid of him in part because they may be worried that he was a bad influence on others, among other things that may have been going on. And he's done time in the joint as well. So this Nails, he could have used a little bit of a personality transplant from the actual Lenny Dykstra.
Who's the boss now? Boss man. That was the first beating in a long line of beatings. You're in my prison now, but I have thrown away the key, and there's nothing you can do about it, and no one can stop me now.
Angela was the boss on Who's the Boss, because she could have easily just fired Tony whenever she wanted to, and she could have put Mona in a home or sent her kids off to any sort of boarding school, because she seemed to be a fairly successful advertising executive and could have afforded that sort of thing. So could have gotten financial aid as a single parent, I think. So anyway, yeah, listening to Nails, the fact that you have to jazz up his promos with the Who's the Boss closing theme song, no wonder why business was down. I mean, could you have given him a manager, for God's sakes? I mean, go back to what works. The heels with managers? I mean, what's Harvey Whippleman doing? I mean, not that I'm an advocate for that guy, but Sid's just left. He's got nothing going on. He's probably just working in the office. Just stick him as, like, the guy who takes on the former prisoner. And by the way, we just did this with Patera 5 years before. The whole guy out of prison thing, now you're doing it as a heel, but could you have picked somebody a little bit better? But okay, so he has the feud with Virgil, who is Boss Man's proxy, although Boss Man does return by July, so he's only kind of out for a month after this beating. He beats Virgil at SummerSlam 92 at Wembley, and by the time October rolls around, we get I love reading house show results, because you get to see and wonder how this match, like, developed, like, what it actually looked like. This six-man tag on one side, Nails, Kamala, and Razor Ramon, and on the other side, the Ultimate Warrior, the Undertaker, and the Big Boss Man. And talk about some babyface fire the other side. Just star power is more like it. And there was an aborted feud with The Undertaker late in the year before the infamous run-in with Vince McMahon, because he was very unhappy about what he was paid in beating Virgil at SummerSlam 92. It always comes back to money when Virgil is involved. Either it's the Million Dollar Man, or you're disappointed with your payoff, or he charged Kevin Wachholz $20 for an 8x10. It's always something with Virgil, but when that happened, he accused Vince of sexual assault, thinking, well, it's clearly plausible because everybody else has been accused, but that was rapidly dismissed, and he lives on in infamy for this character. And you might say, well, he had this one shining moment, interesting phrase, in this college basketball arena, as it was, although this was actually taped in Syracuse, New York, but this show being in Rupp Arena now, which is where he does his first TV match, which is going to be on the following week. Nails, who will forever live on in orange jumpsuit infamy.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Up next, we have the former tag team champions, the Nasty Boys, the house tag team of Greetings from Allentown, as that is where they are billed, although, as I've said, they're actually from Whitehall Township, which, you know, is close enough, in my opinion. They are taking on the team of Major Yates and Reno Riggins, who I gave a bit of a bio on in a previous episode, but he was very busy on this taping per the results of the history of WWE.com. He had three matches. This one, a match against Nails, so one of Nails' first matches, and against Colonel Mustafa, which made me laugh because Colonel Mustafa is still around in May of 1992 when this was taped. And not only that, actually winning matches, although apparently that didn't air on TV. But as for the Nasty Boys, they're kind of going nowhere in the middle of 1992. They're in a sort of a nominal feud with High Energy that's really house show only. They ended up on the pre-show for SummerSlam, which is not a good sign considering that they were the tag team champions a year earlier, defending in Madison Square Garden against the Legion of Doom. Eventually, they turn on Jimmy Hart, but one of the problems of that turn is that it's a little too similar to the Natural Disasters one, which took place in the same calendar year. They were actually upset about being looked over for a tag title shot against Money Inc., which is kind of the same deal, although the Natural Disasters were, their story was that they were passed over for a title shot against LOD at that mysterious Denver show where LOD lost it to Money Inc., and then you rush into the WrestleMania match where the Natural Disasters are now babyfaces against Money Inc. And I'm just thinking about that and how they're a little too similar, I think. I think there might have been a different way to turn the Nasties babyface that it isn't exactly the same as another team you did a week before. And the other problem is they're still heels at this point, but they got overtaken on the heel side by Money Inc. Money Inc. is a team that just kind of materialized out of nowhere in that we've got to get the titles off Legion of Doom because Hawk is a problem, with another recurring 1992 issue for WWF. So they throw together that team rather than going to the Natural Disasters or back to the Nasty Boys. Instead, they create a new team to beat them, and Jimmy Hart is the manager. So now the Nasty Boys are not only down a spot on the heel side in the tag team division, but they're not even number one with their own manager because their own manager is with the tag team champions. So, yeah, Jimmy Hart kind of did do them wrong. In fact, if you think of it from a kayfabe perspective, they probably should have left him sooner because he's probably not going to grant them a lot of tag team title shots, although it actually would make sense if you let your two teams face each other, because then Jimmy Hart will be managing the tag team champions at the end of the day, no matter what happened. Of course, you can say, oh, somebody might get injured, and then he has to forfeit the tag team titles. But, you know, that's so remote. I mean, let's not even think of it. And they are mixing it up with the fans in Kentucky. And they were always ready and willing to do that. Earlier in 1992, maybe a little too willing, because that was the incident where Brian Knobbs got stabbed by a fan shortly before the 1992 Royal Rumble, which is why you see Knobbs in there, but not Sags. Kind of interesting in that Sags is in the 92 Rumble and Knobbs is in the 91 Rumble, but they're never in the Royal Rumble together in either of those years. It's like they're individual singles wrestlers. And they remind me, for their willingness to trash talk the crowd, a little bit of the Dudleys. In fact, that they never really crossed in a major promotion. Not to downgrade TNA, because they did have a feud in 2010 in TNA, which I'm never really going to go back and watch because, you know, why would I, really? And there's nothing unusual from the Nasty Boys here. It's their usual kind of brawling offense. But as I said, they had a nominal feud with High Energy. And Owen and Coco are kind of an interesting duo to put together. Owen and Coco get an inset promo, and something comes out, sounds a little bit weird.
Hey, Birdman, you know what?
What it is, Rocket?
We're going to be blasting up all over the Nasty Boys.
Sounds more like a weekend in Fire Island or Provincetown or something like that to me, rather than a wrestling match. But hey, not that there's anything wrong with that. Avalanche splash by Knobbs, the Irish whip one that they would do, where Knobbs would be whipped by Sags into the corner, and kind of a stinger splash sort of thing. Vince, right before that, as there was a tag to Yates when they Riggins changes out, Vince suggests that cupping a person's ears, kind of like the bell ringer thing, is one of the worst things you can do to a person. I don't know about that. Although that is kind of a dink move that you would see on a playground as a kid, at least that I recall. Power slam by Knobbs and setting up the Nasty Boys finisher, which is the big elbow by Jerry Sags off the top rope. You'd think that maybe with the world champion having a top rope elbow as a finisher, that maybe they would be steered on to something else, but apparently Randy Savage was very secure in his own elbow being more powerful than anyone else's, even a guy who has some 80 pounds on him. So they pick up the win there. But there is a dude in the crowd who is very upset about this, and I need to remember to post this guy's picture on Twitter, because he kind of looks like Lee Marshall, and he's he must have just come from work or something like that. He's got the mustache, and he has a tie on, but for those of you who follow hockey in the National Hockey League, you may know a general manager by the name of Brian Burke. Not the listener to this program, Brian Burke, but the Calgary Flames president. He's been the GM for a lot of different teams. And there's this famous picture of him at the draft when he was, I think, with Toronto, where he has a tie on, but the tie is just around his neck and is completely untied. I don't know if it was just that he didn't like the tie. Well, anyway, this guy who's yelling at the Nasty Boys has his tie exactly like that. So, really kind of funny.
The World Bodybuilding Federation shoots off the big cannons for the WBF Championship live next Saturday, exclusively on pay-per-view. Jerry Stridham defends the WBF Championship in a battle of the bulging biceps. But on the front line will be the Iron Warrior Mike Christian, the Flexing Dutchman Barry DeMay, plus a whole rack of 100% U.S.-tested Grade A prime beef. Don't miss the greatest bodybuilding event in history, the WBF Championship, next Saturday, June 13th.
Now that read is just aces by Vince. It's classic stuff, Grade A beef and all that. I mean, he's certainly in his element talking about bodybuilding, but his advice to the world, or let's keep it to America, to not miss the second World Bodybuilding Federation Championship. Let me just tell you how America tuned out that request by Vince. There were 40 million pay-per-view homes at that time in 1992, and 39,997,000 did not order the show on pay-per-view, leaving a mere 3,000 to purchase the show on pay-per-view. Off the tragedy of losing his son, Eric Clapton wrote the song Tears in Heaven, which was a hit around this time in 1992. And with that, we have a tragic figure in the world of wrestling, the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. And in fact, his whole family. I mean, he had lost three brothers previous to this point. You have David in 1984, Michael in 1987, and then Chris only months before this, in September of 1991, so about 8 or 9 months beforehand. Kerry is taking on Mike Collins, who's very jobberific. He's skinny as all hell and with a mustache, but he's not very important here. It's kind of interesting because I think of Kerry as not being there after WrestleMania 8, although there was a 40-man battle royal that took place on primetime wrestling, in which he was the last man eliminated by the victor, the Berserker. So kind of a footnote in history. As Vince prattles on about the WBF, Kerry makes his way to the ring, and he's kind of Kerry the Kissing Bandit as he's doling out the kisses. I mean, he's taking the whole baby faces must kiss women and babies very, very literally. And he will be appearing at the Personal Fitness Expo, which they are really driving home the point of, you know, the WBF championship and all that. And in fact, I should just play the part where Vince is talking about the WBF on commentary.
The WBF championship sold out for some time, but you can catch it on pay-per-view, ladies and gentlemen, next Saturday night. It's the extravaganza that will set the standard for drug-free competition.
You keep telling yourself that, Vince. And Kerry, he had gone way down the card. I mean, the fact that he was once Intercontinental Champion is just a distant memory as he's feuding with the likes of Skinner, and or at least facing them on house shows, because he doesn't really have a feud on TV. By July, he's putting over Kamala on house shows, which you think about where he came from in world class, and Kamala also did a little stretch in world class as well. And by, you know, 1992, Kamala is, you know, rapidly nearing the end of the line, and Kerry, unfortunately, we find out that, you know, it's near the end of the line for his life by that point, as he had gotten into trouble earlier in the year, which is part of the reason why you think he wasn't around for much of the year. I mean, he is at WrestleMania as part of an eight-man tag, one of those get-everybody-on-the-card sort of deals. But he was suspended as, on February 8th, he was busted for forging prescriptions. And then he is suspended shortly after that because he gave a fake name to the police, too. So he kind of doubled down on the trouble he was in. And he was not only in legal trouble and in hot water with the company, obviously, if he's getting suspended, but he was going through some personal turmoil as well, because he got divorced, his wife separated in April, so that in April is actually when the divorce became finalized. So it's just a sad downward spiral of a guy who just 8 years before this is the NWA World Heavyweight Champion. Now, granted, a lot of that happened because David passed away, and it was a good story, and he only held the title for 18 days. But just think of what happened to him in the meantime, the motorcycle accident, and losing as many brothers as he did. But he still, you know, he looks kind of like himself. He doesn't look like, you know, off kilter or altered in any sort of way. And of all things, because he doesn't have a feud going on, they have him offer up predictions for the WBF Championship.
I'm going to pick the new WBF Champion, and that is none other than David Durth, the Wild Child himself. Then I'll be appearing at the Personal Fitness Expo next weekend, and I will see you there.
Hello, Malibu Stacy Collectors. I'll see you at StacyCon 94 at the San Diego Airport Hilton.
Got to lighten the mood somehow when Kerry's out there. I mean, how many times can you talk about his amputated leg, all of his dead brothers? I mean, might as well just have a throw a Simpsons thing out there to just kind of lighten it up. And the way Kerry phrased it, that he was going to be at the Personal Fitness Expo, kind of reminded me of Waylon Smithers telling us to come to the StacyCon at the San Diego Airport Hilton. A couple clotheslines, a discus punch. I mean, you know the deal with Kerry. That's how he ends up winning this one. And I wondered to myself, because it was an arrest that led to his suicide. And as sad as that is, I wondered, is he a victim of the war on drugs? And I'm going to say, no, not really, because it was actually a second offense of forging a prescription that he got busted on. He had gotten probation the first time, to which I would say maybe some favorable treatment there, given his celebrity or whatever, and that people knew who he was. And the second time, you're violating probation, and he was likely to do a long stretch in jail. And that was part of the reason. I mean, he was already, I think, perhaps suicidal at the time. And, oh my God, I'm getting bummed out again. Let's just move on. Couple of interesting notes about the song Even Flow by Pearl Jam that really have nothing to do with the making of the song itself, maybe interesting only to me. One, to tie it to wrestling, the song, when played backwards, is actually Chris Jericho's WCW theme, which is why you hear it edited out on the network. Of course, they do the stupid thing where they play the Jericho WWF, WWE song that didn't come out until years later as a complete mind screw. It's like when they play Real American for 1984 and 85 Hogan matches. Just drives me insane. Number two, Even Flow at 8 letters in the title is the longest song title on the 10 album. If you look at the list of tracks, it's like all like Once, Why Go, Release. That's coming in at number two at 7 letters. Kind of interesting. That's probably the interesting only to me category. And number three, friends of mine who go see Pearl Jam live much more frequently than I have. I think I've been to 3 shows ever. They use Even Flow as their P song to the point where they claim to me that they have a Pavlovian reaction to the song where every time they hear Even Flow, they automatically have to pee. Anyway, one of my problems with the video is, as I said, all the event centers are edited out, and you could see the choppy edit, and it goes right to our next team, the Beverly Brothers, and they show a sign in the crowd that says Beverly Sisters, because we're not evolved in 92, it's, oh, they're sisters, clearly that's an insult, but it does get, and this, it is good in one regard, is I like to track Vince McMahon's laugh through the years, so I submit for the record the post-WrestleMania 8 Vince McMahon 1992 laugh. Don't you notice that it's a little subdued there? You can tell that business is down just based on Vince's laugh. I mean, compare it to the one from 1985. That's the Vince McMahon laugh that I want. And their opponents here on this day are Mike, Don't Call Me Junior, Samples, and Scott Bailey. Not Scott Bailey, who was a okay goalie for the Boston Bruins in 95 and 96, and then a pretty bad goalie in 96-97. Although, to be fair to him, every single goalie who played for the Bruins in 96-97 was terrible. That's how you finish last in the NHL. They are accompanied by the Genius. And I'm going to take Joe Morata from the Our Vantage Point podcast. And by the way, give a listen to their show. They do a rundown of 1993 and best and worst WWF title matches of the 1990s on their program this week. And on last week's show, he talked about Lanny Poffo and his palms. Now, I had ideas to maybe spice it up, where you give him a rap beat or something maybe to make it a little bit different than what he was. But as he points out, it's done in the same rhyming scheme often and in the same meter, I guess it would be, in terms of his poetry. And he said, ba 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 ba, baka baka baka. And now all I hear is baka 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 every single time I hear Lanny Poffa. But fine, that's okay. As he's got the Legion of Doom in the crosshairs, as these two teams are feuding. The LOD had returned after the brief hiatus at WrestleMania 8, where they come out on the interview platform in extremely random fashion. You don't see a lot of platform interviews at WrestleMania. I was kind of left scratching my head, like, what is this, an episode of Challenge or something? Like, oh, and Paul Ellering is here, and Heenan oversells it to the point like, oh my God, you know who that is? And, you know, yeah, I know who that is. It's the guy that they don't need because they can cut promos on their own. But apparently Paul Ellering was an actual real-life manager as well, and they may have needed him around. Not that he did any good, because, you know, they didn't even last through the end of the year, and it's 3 weeks after this that Rocco the Puppet makes his debut. But okay, that's fine. Cycle back now to the genius and his poem, which I have to say, maybe Murata didn't ruin all of them for me, because this didn't sound too terrible.
The LOD are sissies. That's the simple, honest truth. Their conduct is repulsive and predictably uncouth. Before the Beverly Brothers put an end to this disgrace, let the genius reassure you, this will help the human race.
It's not his worst effort, except for the fact that the term sissy is not something that holds up in today's society. And I was interested in learning the etymology of the word sissy. It does have a positive connotation, although that's lost, as a term of affection towards women, particularly an older sister. It's kind of been overtaken as like that playground insult. You know, I remember hearing it in elementary school in the 80s, but going back and reading about the history of it, is the original meaning was sister, and it entered the English language back in the 1840s, but did not become a pejorative term, an insult, until around 1885 or 1890. And sissify comes early 20th century, where you make it into a verb. And this was actually interesting in reading about it. It says, by the 1930s, there was no more damning insult than to be called a sissy, and the word was widely used by American football coaches and sports writers to disparage rival teams and encourage ferocious player behavior. The use of the word sissy was ubiquitous among delinquent American youth of the 1930s. The term was used to provoke boys to join gangs, demean boys who violated group norms, force compliance with the mandates of masculinity, and justify violence, including sexual violence against younger and weaker children. I think the lesson here is, if you have a time machine, never go back in time to the 1930s. Before they even get going with this match, the Beverlys go to the outside of the ring. So they see a kid at ringside wearing Legion of Doom shoulder pads, which if he's going to buy a piece of I know he's a plant, but if you're going to buy a piece of merchandise in 1992 WWF, I'm not sure I would buy the LOD red shoulder pads with the foam spikes. I just don't think that they look good at all. At the same time, if you went to an independent show wearing one of them now, you'd really stand out in the sea of black t-shirts with those red shoulder pads. So they're picking on the kid and saying that they are the Legion of Sissies and all that. And I really hope that the kid kept those shoulder pads. I did not look up how much those might be worth on eBay. I certainly don't think it reaches the level of the Mind Doll or the stretch figures. I mentioned in the past the problems with the Beverly Brothers gimmick. They're just sort of prep school kids or something like that. Like, why are they wearing purple? Why are they wearing, like, these giant capes or whatever you would call it? There's really no logic, I don't think, behind it, which is why it didn't have a chance from the word go. They were originally managed by Coach before going on to the Genius, which made a hell of a lot more sense. I mean, why can't they just be the Minnesota Wrecking Crew or just give them a name like that. It's just they should have been in a line of badass tag teams like what you see with the Revival today, with the Andersons back in the day. They should have been somewhere in the middle of that timeline. There's going to be more on Enos and Bloom, their AWA time, because they'll be making an appearance on next week's show. Hint, hint on where I am going with that. So the Shaker Heights spike ends it. Very reminiscent of kind of a little bit like what the Dudley Death Drop would be years later. I don't know why I feel the need to compare every single tag team on this show to the Dudleys. Probably because when High Energy comes up later, there's no way I can compare those two. But when they're done, they are not finished. They go back down to the Kid and they take his shoulder pads, and the Genius just happens to have a thing of paint to deface the shoulder pads and write LOS on them. And even then, that's not it, because they pull out a skull cap that has the hairdo of Animal from Legion of Doom. So they have the shoulder pads on, they put the head on like, ha ha ha, we're mocking them. And yes, that Beverly Brothers Legion of Doom feud, you probably have forgotten all about it. I know I have. And if I hadn't just recently watched SummerSlam 1992 to prepare for my SummerSlam podcast with Steve Bennett that we'll be recording later this week and that I expect to be released next week, probably on Monday or Tuesday, be on the lookout for that. I would have assumed those two teams would have met at SummerSlam, but the Legion of Doom famously came out on motorcycles. This is right before Hawk's disappearance from the company for a period of time. More on that in a little bit as we get to our next match, because I have a few notes on that. But they did not face each other there. The Beverlys faced the Natural Disasters for the tag team titles, and the Legion of Doom were facing Money Inc., I guess to freshen things up, because you'd seen Money Inc. versus the Natural Disasters already at WrestleMania with the Money Inc. walking away countout finish, which feels like when you look at the results of tag team title matches in 1992 when Money Inc. is the champion, awful lot of count-out losses, presumably because they just sort of walked away from the match, which is like such a crap finish. And when you do it that often, it's not really building heat at all. But the Beverly Brothers getting a title shot, even though, just in my mind, they never really came close to getting to that level in the WWF.
Police Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceFanation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Weekend Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a vertical podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and thehistoryofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Once again, another awkward cut out of the event center goes right to Crush versus George Anderson. This is not the George Anderson who is one of the most renowned psychic mediums in the world, at least according to his website. Although I did look into it and I laughed because I'm scrolling down and it's talking about his tour. And he says, unfortunately, I have had to cancel my Australia tour. It's like, well, you probably should have seen that coming, huh, Mr. George Anderson? This is just a WWF job guy from the early 90s. And Kona Crush, wearing the very colorful outfit here in 1992. Demolition is in the rearview mirror. And I always am amused by the fact that they never, ever pretended that it was the same guy. But they just kept the same name on him, but just made him very colorful, like almost the antithesis of Demolition Crush with the S&M gear and all that sort of stuff. So now he's the friendly Hawaiian, which, okay, it's fine. And I had mentioned about the Legion of Doom in the last match, and Crush, this is so weird. It's one of those, I don't know, I guess time is a flat circle sort of things, because he's most infamous for taking over the spot of Axe, working alongside him for a while, and then Axe leaves the WWF after the Survivor Series in 1990, and then it's just Smash and Crush. Well, he also replaced Hawk in the Legion of Doom when Hawk went AWOL after SummerSlam, as I mentioned, and so there was Crush and Animal with Paul Ellering. So he happened to be the imposter guy in both Demolition and the Legion of Doom. If there was only a way he could have substituted in for the Warlord or the Barbarian and done the Powers of Pain, like that would have been like the triple crown of impostery, I think. The colorful outfit is certainly of the time period in 1992. You get, you know, cross colors or whatever it was back then. I can't remember the names of the colorful pants that a lot of kids at school would wear at the time. He kind of looks like a Juicy or IPA or something like that. I don't know why it reminds me of that. It's probably the beer that I really like. But I'm also quite fond of Jobber Records in Cage Match or any of the sites where you can get an aggregate record on a guy. But it can also be interesting for a guy like Crush, who, when you think of this run of him as a babyface, the first thing that comes to mind is 1993 and him losing to Doink in embarrassing fashion at WrestleMania 9 with the second Doink getting hit with a fake arm and all that sort of stuff. But in 1992, this guy was extremely well protected. Whether he was on that quote-unquote list for the WWF title, I very much doubt that, because he would have been a terrible choice at the time. But his record for the year 1992 in the WWF, and I hope you're sitting down for this, is 127 wins, 0 losses, and 2 draws, which were both double countouts against the Warlord earlier in the year. And I don't think of Kona Crush and the Warlord ever crossing paths, but again, maybe if he could have taken over for the Warlord and teamed with the Barbarian, we could have had that thing. Vince on commentary gives the Big Boss Man a shout out, because they're still thinking of him even as he's sitting home convalescing. A press slam by Crush early on, and he certainly looks the part, Bryan Adams, but there's absolutely no charisma, and when he tries to be charismatic, there's a certain, I don't know, it just comes off as very inauthentic. And compare it with a guy like Sid, who is just oozing charisma in there, and he's not a good pro wrestler by anyone's standard, but the charisma is just oozing off him at all times. And when you're a big guy like that, it might not be the most important thing to have, but you have to have at least some of it, or at least be able to fake it effectively. And I don't think Crush / Bryan Adams was ever able to even do that. And we'll take an example here, because he gets an inset promo, because he doesn't really have a feud set in stone. He faces Repo Man at SummerSlam 92. Demolition explodes in Wembley Stadium, except we're not calling them Demolition anymore. But listen to this promo, where he is also forced to talk about the WBF.
From one Crush to another, I predict Gary Stridham will crush all his competition in the WBF Championship. Also, this crush will be at the Personal Fitness Expo next weekend.
Well, kudos to him for correctly predicting Gary Stridham to repeat as WBF champion, as if anything else was going to happen. I mean, good prediction. It's not like he went on a podcast and said he wouldn't be surprised if the Baltimore Orioles won 95 games this year. Didn't do anything embarrassing like that. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's dead. That's why he didn't do that. But what is up with the halting promo style of Crush? It's driving me nuts. It's almost as if William Shatner became a professional wrestler and decided to call himself Crush. Ugh. Spinning Backbreaker by Crush, as he does that move that I was trying to describe either last week or the week before. And then he starts making a motion with his hands because he's going for the head vice submission finisher, which I don't quite get how this is supposed to work. Like, he's pushing in on the guy's head and he's supposed to give up in that move. But apparently he could actually get the crowd to do the same thing with their hands. Now imagine, if you will, being in a WWF crowd in 1992 and actually being captured on camera doing that motion, signaling for Crush to do this ridiculous head vice submission. For all of time, you're on video being seen doing that. It's embarrassing, right? I think it would be. And he, by the way, after the submission happens and he's declared the victor, he helps his opponent up. And this is actually kind of funny. He raises his opponent's hand like he's, you know, being a good sportsman and all. And after he does, he lets go. And then he just turns to walk away. And Anderson, the guy, he just collapses in the center of the ring. It was really kind of humorous.
And there he is, helping his opponent up. You don't often see that display of sportsmanship. Very often. Woo, yeah!
Vince throws it to Gene Okerlund on the interview platform, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's right. There's no talk show segment in the WWF in the summer of 1992. It's just the platform. And I thought, is there anybody who was capable of hosting a talk show segment on one of the two shows? The only one I could come up with, and I gave myself a few minutes to think of one, is the genius, perhaps, could have had something. As long as he doesn't read a poem every single week, maybe like The Genius's Classroom or something. I know it's very Dean Douglas, but that's not until a couple of years later. I think that's something that could have worked, and I think it would have been a fun moment for the genius to have on the WWF champion, the Macho Man Randy Savage, on The Genius's Classroom or whatever. But we're stuck with the interview platform, and Gene Okerlund welcomes out Papa Shango, and it is a nice relief to talk about a guy named Papa who isn't some racist dude making pizza. God, I'm really sick of that story. It's not like I've eaten Papa John's in the last 20 years. I mean, ugh. So anyway, Papa Shango, he was up to some things, more specifically with the Ultimate Warrior, and had cursed him and caused him to do things that might happen if you ate too much Papa John's pizza, like, you know, be hunched over in the ring like you have a stomach ache, black goo coming down the warrior's face as he's doing something, doing an interview on the platform. And at one point, he got rushed to the back, and he started throwing up all over the medics, which I watched the clip of that on YouTube, and I laughed uncontrollably for about 4 straight minutes, which is a terrible thing because it means that I'm laughing in the exact same manner as Vince McMahon was. He's gonna puke! And it's the exact same thing that he's doing there. The warrior throws up this green stuff. Apparently it was a veggie pizza from Papa John's. I don't know what it was that he might have eaten. But As I said, I had watched a little bit after WrestleMania 8, and one of the things I do remember watching was the Ultimate Warrior interview on the platform, and I thought it was strange that he was wearing a white jacket with, you know, his own picture on the back of it, but fine, whatever. But that's to hide the mechanism that would make the black goo come down his face that Papa Shango would do when he had cursed him after a match. And I just remember watching it and cringing in embarrassment as a 13-year-old. Like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life. And it was such a turnoff that I didn't watch for the longest time. Other such things he would do is he would light a jobber's feet on fire and do the goo trick there. And I'm thinking, so what? The 1986 Mets, they were doling out hot foots on a daily basis. We're supposed to be impressed that Papa Shango gives a guy a hot foot? Yeah, I'm not buying it here. So you think, okay, well, maybe Papa Shango, this guy, eventually goes on to become the Godfather and a WWE Hall of Famer, which we can talk about the whole merits of that another time. But he was somebody who got the crowd up in the late 90s, no pun intended. But his promos as Papa Shango are, I'm trying to figure out what the word for it is. Oh, yeah, bad.
Ultimate Warrior, how does it feel not to be in control? Ultimate Warrior, how does it feel? Entered the dark world of Papa Shango. You have stepped into my black circle. And that circle is closing on you.
Oh, boy.
We all have our own personal hell that you can probably think of. And for me, I think it would be being forced to sit and watch a promo battle between Papa Shango and the Ultimate Warrior for four consecutive hours. I would truly want to off myself at the end of it. And Gene Okerlund, he's creeped out by all of this and is like, oh, thank God this is over. And as Papa Shango is walking away, he decides to put a curse on Gene, which is the same old thing. You know, the black goo fluid starts coming out of Gene's suit jacket that he's wearing. Although, to be fair to Okerlund, I think it could have been Kahlua. I mean, I've seen the shoot interviews and read reviews of things people have said about Gene Okerlund, stuff he would keep in his jacket. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if a bottle of alcohol leaked and was coming out there, and it was just Kahlua or Drambuie. It could have been any number of things. But the crowd, at the same time, they don't really react to this because they can't see what's going on. This is for the television audience. So you have to do some sweetening to this because there's no other choice because the crowd, because they can't see it, they can't react to it. But this thing was going to be a failure even if it was done, let's say, in a TV studio. You know, like I said, the nails thing would have come off better then. Maybe this would have come off better. But as I said before, voodoo is a babyface gimmick. Voodoo as a heel gimmick, you're just kind of, I don't know, it just does not work that way. It just doesn't.
But sometimes love sounds like a fight. It sounds like an argument. It sounds just like a power driver.
Get to our next match, which is High Energy, the team of Coco Beware and the Rocket Owen Hart taking on Kevin Kruger and Kato of the Orient Express. I'm left wondering, Coco Beware's two main theme songs that he had, which was Pile Driver off the Pile Driver album, or The Bird, the later theme that's very jazzy and up-tempo, which one do I like better? And I think right now I'm at that point where it actually crosses in my mind where I kind of like them equally. So maybe I'll put a poll out on Facebook or something. In fact, you may have already seen it by the time this show is released because I kind of feel like putting that up right now. But of course, High Energy, one of the things about them is the outfits, which are really just the new Foundation outfits. Carried over with Coco Beware. I don't think he would fit necessarily into Jim the Anvil Neidhart's outfit, except for the fact that Coco is getting a little chunky. But Mr. Perfect, who I haven't played much from him on commentary because I feel like sometimes he's a little too cute with his comments. And he's not quite as funny as a guy like Jesse, and certainly not as funny as Heenan. He makes kind of the standard crack about the high energy gear.
It looks like a couple of drivers from Checker Cab Company.
Yeah, that feels a little bit more cliched than something you would get out of the brain or the body on color commentary. But as they're doing their thing, as they get in there, because it's Coco Beware, he has to dance, and he high-fives Owen, and Owen is doing the bird in front of Frankie, which is a hilarious visual with Owen Hart flapping his hands in front of the bird. Because there is an African-American man dancing, this means we get another Vince McMahon laugh, so let's check in if his laugh has improved from earlier.
Get with it. Loosen up. Yeah, I'm with it.
Well, that certainly is a better laugh than what we had earlier, so I guess his mood is picking up a little bit. And we certainly know by now that Mr. Perfect doesn't like any music made by African Americans, which is what led to the West Texas Rednecks in 1999. And Vince wants Perfect to do the bird, but Vince he then takes a shot at Vince, saying that he has chicken legs. Which, you know, always a good way to needle Vince is to say his body doesn't look good or something like that. I'm looking at Kato or Kato. Maybe I've been listening to too much Lord Alfred Hayes because maybe it is Kato just because it starts with a K, because he's not the Cato Institute, you know, that think tank in Washington, D.C. Why does he have to be masked? I don't quite understand why he can't just be Paul Diamond at this point, because Tanaka, he's gone. He went to the USWA after the Royal Rumble. I guess you stay in the Kato role where you're masked in order to protect Paul Diamond for a point later down the road, which actually would come in the form of Max Moon and a couple of other things that I am forgetting about. And Kato does some arm work on Owen, who does the usual gymnastics moves to get out of the arm wringer. This leads to sometimes Vince, when he gets in later into the 90s, could be quite lazy on his play-by-play. The 1-2-3, he got him. No, he didn't. Absolutely insane watching SummerSlam 94 and to a lesser extent SummerSlam 95. But listen to this sequence here.
What a maneuver by Owen Hart.
Uh-oh, retaliation by Kato.
They're going to have their hands full getting by Kato here, McMahon.
Time will tell.
What a maneuver again. Off the rope, Kato leapfrog. Kato charging.
Oh, how about that maneuver? What do you say about that, Mr. Perfect?
Great maneuver. I'll give it.
Okay. All right.
If I was doing commentary at an independent wrestling show, I would see how many times I could work in maneuver, as in what a maneuver, or how they worked it in four times in that 22-second clip just there. Coco comes in off the second rope, but he does kind of a funny thing. The baggy pants that they have, he hitches them really, really high. And as I said, Coco's a little bit chubby, so maybe it's to hide the gut a little bit. And Mr. Perfect actually makes a point where by hiking the pants up, it now means hitting below the belt is a much larger area than it was previously. So you wonder, well, why don't more wrestlers wear high pants like that? The Nasty Boys have an inset promo because we heard from High Energy during the Nasty Boys match, so it's only fair that we get the editorial reply, or the rebuttal, if you will.
High Energy, the Nasty Boys are gonna anesthetize you, baby!
No birds are flying, no rockets are soaring. It's not the sensation for you two.
Yeah, the rocket's still gonna crash and burn, and that Paisley Burns still gonna get plucked. The Nasty Boys are gonna short circuit High Energy.
Hey, Laser Lips, your mama was a snowblower.
I have to admit I've never seen the movie Short Circuit, but that was such a common insult on the second grade playground at my school that I wasn't going to pass up an opportunity to play it. And Kato misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge. He takes a swing and misses and gets hit with an atomic drop and then a drop kick. And he tags out to Kevin Kruger, because we know who's eating the pin here. One half of the old Orient Express ain't eating the pin. It's going to be old Kevin Kruger who's going to be counting the lights on this evening. Vince and Perfect continue their conversation from earlier about High Energy's outfit, and Mr. Perfect doesn't seem to know what spandex is, because he refers to it as such, but they're wearing baggy pants. They're like clown pants. I'll admit, they were the style at the time, but you know, it's most certainly not spandex. And there's no tag by Owen and Coco, but yet they go ahead and double team, which was a little heelish. I had Jesse Ventura in my ear complaining about it. And Owen holds up Kruger a la, you know, going for the Rougeau bomb that the Rougeaus used to do. But instead, we get a missile drop kick off the top rope by Coco. And Owen cradles his man up in a roll up, hooking both legs for the pin. And actually, I had screwed up my notes, because Owen dances with Frankie after the match and not before, but still, it's a fun visual either way, because Owen Hart is all about having that fun out there in the ring, and a victory for High Energy.
Why must you turn my office into a house of lies?
Our final match is the Repo Man taking on Dan Robbins, who is billed from Grand Rapids, Michigan, a place you should definitely visit if you like good beer, or even a good bourbon bar like Stella's, or if you're a history nerd and you want to go to the Gerald Ford Museum. Some odd travel tips, I know, but Grand Rapids is very, very nice. I certainly want to go back there someday. So, Repo Man, I covered his debut in one of the November 1991 episodes of Superstars that I covered, and I kind of took credit. I was like, oh, I knew he was used to be Demolition Smash before anybody else at my school, but quite frankly, Helen Keller could have identified him as Demolition Smash. Actually, probably Crusher Khrushchev, because Helen Keller was from the South, and that's where Dasso made his name as the Russian sympathizer back in the day. I wonder if Helen Keller would have subscribed to the Pro Wrestling Torch. Anyway, I'm kind of going off the beaten path here. There's really not much in this Repo Man match. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention and just kind of lost focus as I rapidly became depressed with the quality of this show, not having any commercials or any interviews or whatever in the event center. And I know, as the old saying goes, a wise man once said that if you've heard one Barry Darso promo, no matter what character it is, you've heard them all, but you're going to hear one more.
Not only am I the best repo man in the country, I'm the best dog catcher! And as you have found out, there's no escape. You will obey me, because I'm
your master!
Yes, another feud you've probably forgot about, him and the British Bulldog, which certainly didn't last long, because the Bulldog would go on win the IC title and would famously be kind of out of commission for a period of time before that show took place, and he was carried to such a terrific match by Bret Hart. I'm wondering, did he repossess Winston or anything? It's like, no, they're not going to return to the kidnapping Matilda angle of 1987, since pretty much the second they got it, they almost had to unwind it right away, because even animal rights groups back then were going to jump down their throat. When I see Repo Man just writing the name out in my notebook, and I see Repo, and of course it's short for repossess, and that's his job, but those of us in the financial world, when we see the word repo, it actually is short for repurchase agreement, which, long story short, a mutual fund will purchase what is basically like a one-day bond, where, you know, for $2 million or whatever amount, you'll purchase it, and then it'll get repurchased the next day. It'll be treated like the maturity of a bond. You know, just long story short, there's more that goes into it. I don't mean to turn this into a mutual funds podcast or anything, but it's certainly more exciting than talking about the wrestling repo man who picks up the win with the half crab. Yes, he doesn't even give us a full Boston crab. He's just giving us a half crab. It's a weak finisher, but again, so is the concept of a wrestling repo man. Although, I suppose even repo men have to pay the bills, because what happens to repo man if he misses a bunch of car payments? Who will repo from the repo man?
I mean, if you're the police, who will police the police?
Oh, Coast Guard?
Geez, I've been leaning awfully hard on those Simpsons clips. They've been doing a lot of work for me here. You know what I think it is? I think it's because as I'm recording this right now, I am actually watching The Simpsons on mute on FXX. It's the one where Bart is grounded from watching the Itchy and Scratchy movie from season 4. So it would have been fun if I had actually pulled one from that episode, but I haven't yet. Oh yeah, Repo Man, he hook ties his opponent's legs together and then just kind of drags him around the ring a little bit. It's not exactly the Big Boss Man handcuffing a guy to the rope and then beating the hell out of him, but it's really inconveniencing the poor jobber who has to get it, like, his legs untied so he can walk to the back. Really kind of a jerk move, but honestly, Repo Man, for all that you can say, and I love the Barry D'Urso, like, delusional shoot interviews are like, yeah, they were going to turn my character into a big baby face, and I was going to get a push. Like, when it comes to the delusional shoot interview circuit, that certainly ranks in my top 5, maybe top 10 for stuff that I've heard over the years. I mean, quite frankly, wouldn't they have just been better off licensing the Hamburglar and just going all in and having a Hamburglar character? Could have had a whole stable with Grimace and the rest of them. As I said earlier, I'm watching this and I see that there are 15 minutes left after the Repo Man match, but they actually wrap things up because this video mysteriously goes into what I think is the next week's episode of Superstars, which has Shawn Michaels and some other guys on there as well. But I'm only going to focus on this particular show. So that's a wrap for WWF Superstars for June 6, 1992. But I am not done here, as we have another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. And it took me 3 different tries because this video is on YouTube in 3 different places. However, all 3 of them have the same thing where it's 15 minutes of the next week's show as it leads in. So I'm going to try to only use comments making a point about the show that I'm actually covering. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left on the video of the show in question. The KD911 says, "The many faces of Vince McMahon, I like this one the best. Doesn't acknowledge that he's the owner of the company and just plays the gung-ho, naive babyface announcer." Oh, this isn't even the best Vince McMahon as an announcer character that there ever was. I personally like the late 70s, early 80s kind of serious sports announcer Vince McMahon, but I also like the one when he really gets feisty with Jesse Ventura. I like when he rips on Jesse and kind of gives it back to him. That's the Vince that I like the best, even, you know, pre-Mr. McMahon character. The BC 313 says, "I remember being 9 and having to leave the room when Papa Shango started putting his curse on Mean Gene. My friend, who was also 9, looked at me like, 'You big pussy.' I gave no fucks. He scared the shit out of me." It didn't really scare me at all. Of course, I'm a little bit older watching it, and I am exposed to voodoo previously watching Pedro Serrano in Major League. Like I said, it's a babyface gimmick, so I wasn't spooked out by it. In fact, I might have been mildly offended by the fact that they were making light of somebody's beliefs. You know, voodoo is a religion and a way of life in some places. Pop-Tarts, yes, this is the person's name, says, without the slightest sense of irony, Vince talked about the, quote, drug-free competition in the WBF at the same time Kerry Von Erich was making his way down to the ring. And, you know, I'm surprised I didn't put those together. And I don't know why I would have missed that, because usually I can connect those dots, but I have failed in this case. But that's what YouTube Comment Theater is here for. Sergio Cazares says, I never realized until a few days ago that Smash of Demolition and Repo Man are one and the same. So I guess maybe I shouldn't. I should feel good about myself for figuring out, because old Sergio had no idea. Daniel Santana says, J.J. Dillon was part of WWE creative team in the early 1990s, and he gave Charles Wright the Papa Shango gimmick. In 1993 video game Royal Rumble for Sega Genesis, Papa Shango was a Sega Genesis exclusive superstar. I'm not sure I entirely buy the J.J. Dillon stuff, because I don't really think he was that much of a force in creative or anything like that, or at least he never goes into it in his book, but I more read that for the interesting tidbit about Papa Shango being a exclusive character for the game on Sega Genesis. ESSJ333 says, notice Mean Gene has his left hand in the pocket in where he is squeezing one end of the squirter tube, and it's pouring the black liquid out of his right wrist. I love the people who go on to like comment about like magic tricks and explain how it's happening. It was stupid anyway, so I don't really need to know how it was done. Akuma4U says, I remember seeing the Nails Boss Man beating in its entirety, and Boss Man sold the beating so well, especially at the end when he was panting and mucus was coming out of his mouth, which they didn't show here, but if you see the full beating, you can see it. It made me feel so uncomfortable when I was a kid. It was very disturbing. And yeah, the full thing is much more brutal when you watch it. And Boss Man, maybe I didn't appreciate the cell job he did. Probably because, you know, the whole Nails thing was just a miserable failure, and that his cell job at the end of the day ended up meaning nothing. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Elsewhere in podcast land, the wrestling podcast about nothing, Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis are reunited after 3 weeks with other people doing the show, and they continue their summer of negativity, which has actually been quite a bit of fun. And this time they talk about their worst days in the wrestling business, and Malonis had a particularly funny story about a truck that got lost in the Boston area, which made me laugh, because a truck getting lost in Boston feels like it could end up on Storrow Drive at any point and just end up what's known around here as Storrowing itself on a bridge, because you're not supposed to have trucks on the parkway. Storrow Drive is like a parkway here. And on the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett, he has on Max Olson, who is a college football reporter for The Athletic, a national college football reporter. And also Jeff Perlman, who he's had on several times, and he's one of the best recurring guests on the Sportscasters. And I'm looking over my bookcase, and I have a couple of Jeff Perlman books in there. I think the one from the 80 on the 86 Mets, The Bad Guys Won, is in there somewhere, and The Rocket That Fell Back to Earth, which is the book that he wrote about Roger Clemens, I want to say, about 7 or 8 years ago. I think it was after The Rocket called it quits on his career. And I'm very close to calling it quits here, but for next week's show, because I am going to Minneapolis the following weekend, I have to do an AWA show. That's the rules. I don't like it, but it's the way I do things here. And I've been progressively getting a little later in the AWA with each time. I covered a show from 1986. Then I went to about 13 months later to May of 1987. And this time I'm going to skip over 1988 entirely and go right to a show that I remember watching when it happened, when it originally aired on ESPN on February 18th, 1989. The AWA stages a battle royal to determine the new AWA quote-unquote world heavyweight champion. And what a crew of guys they got. There are more bright, shining stars in that ring than in all of the galaxy, I can assure you, on AWA television in 1989. So do tune in. That. Thank you so much for listening to the show. And spread the word wherever you can about Greetings from Allentown, whether it be on message boards or even on an iTunes Apple Music review. 5 stars is most certainly appreciated, not only for my own feed, but also for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. Make sure to give that a review as well. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Over.